This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson today. We've had another week of the partial government shutdown, and the battle between President Donald Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has intensified. In Los Angeles, they're facing a shutdown of another kind with thousands of teachers on strike and protesting, and there's been a ruling regarding the 2020 census. And yesterday, Cardi B got political. Here with me in the studio for the domestic edition of the Friday News Roundup is Time Magazine national political correspondent Molly Ball. She's also a CNN political analyst. Molly, great to see you again.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And we have Ozma Khalid in Boston, NPR political reporter, first-time Roundup guest. Ozma, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We have to start with the Russia investigation, which we spent some time on this show yesterday, because this week was, well, maybe historic for that investigation. There was a giant scoop from the New York Times, a giant scoop from the Washington Post. We had those on the show yesterday. And then last night, a bombshell. Look, I know we throw around the term bombshell, but guys, this one is hurtling toward the earth and it's ready to blow. In BuzzFeed last night, they reported that former Trump attorney Michael Cohen lied to Congress about the president's business dealings in Russia, and he did it on the president's orders, and that Bob Mueller has the communications to prove it. Now, perjury or suborning of perjury came up multiple times during this week's confirmation hearings for Bill Barr, the man who Donald Trump has picked to be the next attorney general. Listen to this exchange between Barr and Democratic Senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar.
In your memo, you talked about the Comey decision. You wrote on page one that a president persuading a person to commit perjury would be obstruction. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Or any person who persuades another.
Okay.
That is Amy Klobuchar drilling down on the idea of obstructioning and convincing another person to hide evidence. You were listening to William Barr there, Trump's pick to be attorney general. There were so many developments this week on this topic. But before we dig into them a little bit further, let's start with this biggest news. The BuzzFeed report, Molly Ball, I described it as a bombshell, and I don't like to throw that term around because it gets overused, but I think it fits.
Yeah, and I don't think the sheer quantity of bombshells that tend to come at us in these eventful days ought to in some way diminish their magnitude. There's just a lot of really big things that we are learning and that are happening. And so this report, as you say, it is a bombshell. There are some things in here that we already knew. We already knew because of some of the, I believe, charging documents for Michael Flynn about his contention that his admission that he had lied about the extent to which these talks with Russia were going on as they tried to build a Trump Tower Moscow, even as the 2016 campaign was underway. He at one point said that stopped before the campaign, and then he admitted that that wasn't true. However, it's the contacts with Trump that are revealed here, and also even more striking almost than the allegation is the evidence that it appears to be based on. The BuzzFeed report states that there are all kinds of documents, emails, potentially recordings that this is based on. And so, you know, I just saw on television Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani saying, well, this is just Michael Cohen. We know he's a liar. He's admitted to being a liar. The danger here for the president is that this is not simply based on Michael Cohen's word, that this is based on a whole lot of evidence, and then it becomes very difficult to deny.
They call those receipts what Michael Cohen, what Bob Mueller apparently has, according to BuzzFeed. Ozma Khalid, a lot of members of Congress, certainly on the Democratic side, have been on social media and on television since last night, really calling this one a game changer.
That's right. I mean, we saw the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. I believe it was late last night. He was on Twitter talking about how serious these allegations are and that he, you know, his committee would do what's necessary to find out if it's true. Look, I think that, as Molly was suggesting, there has been so much that it's hard to decipher at times, like, what is really significant and what isn't. And in this, I think that the reason this is rising up to a level of significance is because, you know, I just saw actually a comment from Eric Erickson. He's a sort of well-known conservative commentator. He was talking about, if this is true, it's an impeachable offense. And, you know, he has a lot of cautionary notes about deciphering whether or not this is true, but that is why this is rising up to such a level of significance compared to some of the other bombshells we've heard recently.
listeners have been tweeting at us and writing in already about this BuzzFeed Mueller bombshell. Cindy writes, it's been reported that one of the unverified sources said this in the story. I guess I can call up and make up a story about Trump and it'll get reported. LOL. That's one listener's view. Molly Ball, you pointed out that this one's not really about Michael Cohen's veracity, at least according to the story, that if this story advances, one of the things that BuzzFeed reported was that Michael Cohen originally lied to Bob Mueller about whether he had been truthful with Congress. Then Mueller went back to Michael Cohen and said, actually, Mike, we've got emails, we've got texts, we've got communications. Do you want to change your story? Michael Cohen said, okay, you got me.
That's right. And that is how a good prosecutor operates. This is totally within the norm of how law enforcement investigations usually proceed. They are not generally based on one person's word. But just to address the listener's journalistic concern here, I think this is an important and understandable concern that people have whenever anonymous sources are used. But we, in the journalism business, we may sometimes have to conceal our sources, but we don't lie. And what BuzzFeed says in this story is that these are law enforcement sources. This isn't apparently Michael Cohen or some random person who simply called up and claimed. And if you're a reporter in this situation, you know that you have to be that much more careful to verify a story if it's going to be based on anonymous sources. So the reporters in this circumstance are going to want to have actually seen some of the evidence in question, are going to want to have more than one source who are saying the same thing independent of each other before you proceed with a report like this, because the last thing you want is to be wrong or to have to retract something like this. And I think we'll have a better idea of how solid this report is when and if other outlets begin to confirm some of those details.
We had news from the New York Times. We had news from the Washington Post this week. The New York Times reported that at one point the FBI opened an investigation into the president himself, questioning whether he may be an asset of the Kremlin. Terry writes about the BuzzFeed story, the plot thickens. Was this shutdown a diversion by 45 to keep us looking the other way? Terry, I doubt it. I doubt it was a Machiavellian false flag. But let's talk about the government shutdown, because it drags on. We're towing up to a month here, 28 days, the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history. 800,000 federal workers are living without pay. The pain is rippling across the country. Ozma, what about this stalemate? Any closer to a resolution? I know the answer to that. The answer is no. Mm-hmm. And we have the president and the Speaker of the House now taking pretty high-level swipes at one another.
Yeah, I mean, Todd, as you said, I do not think that we are any closer to a compromise today than we were, say, 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago even. And at this point, I think it's really unclear to see where the end is, in part because some of this is beginning to look very petty and personal, right? So we saw that Nancy Pelosi suggested that Donald Trump, and requested actually, that the State of the Union, the annual State of the Union address, be moved given the government shutdown. Donald Trump, he responded, or it's unclear, he's sort of saying it wasn't in full retaliation, but he canceled a trip that Nancy Pelosi was planning to take to Afghanistan. He pulled the plug on that international trip. And so some of this is beginning to feel very tit for tat. And in the scheme of things, there are so many people who have been suffering without paychecks. Whether or not they will eventually receive back pay is sort of besides the point if you are unable to pay your bills at this point in time. And the other major thing I think economically we're beginning to see is the White House is also acknowledging that the shutdown is inflicting more damage on the economy than they initially expected. It's hurting economic growth.
For the first time ever, members of the armed forces are going unpaid due to the shutdown, members of the Coast Guard. The hardship is starting to be felt. Celebrity chef Jose Andres in Washington, D.C. has been making meals for federal workers who are facing hardship. Listen to Lindsey Graham on Capitol Hill, Republican member of Congress who has his own recommendation about how to get out of this.
Less damage than if we don't fix a broken immigration system. You got two bad choices here. Continue the stalemate and see parts of the government shut down. It will be inconvenient and it can create problems. And to the federal workforce, I'm sorry you caught up in this mess. But the real damage is people coming across the border, selling drugs, killing Americans. That needs to come to the end. So the real damage is a broken border compared to a partial shutdown.
Molly Ball, Lindsey Graham has said, open up the government for a couple of weeks and let's get money for that wall. That will get us out of this.
And that has apparently been a non-starter with the White House. You hear in what Lindsey Graham is saying, obviously he's become a staunch ally of the president, but he also, for upwards of a decade, has been trying to get comprehensive immigration reform done. And you hear him saying, let's fix the immigration system. What he would like to do, and what we don't see any signs that the White House is moving toward, is to make this part of a bigger deal where there would be something offered to the Democrats, something like, you know, citizenship for the Dreamers or legalization of the existing undocumented population in exchange for the wall. But part of the reason for this stalemate is there haven't been any offers of compromise. You haven't had, and in fact, we heard that the president actually dressed down an aide who tried to start finding a number between the $5 billion that the president requested and the $1 billion that the Democrats have already agreed to. So it's hard when there's no wiggle room there to find anything in the middle.
I've been hearing from so many of you. Cheryl emails, I am absolutely perplexed that all the media seems to put the weight of the shutdown on the shoulders of Nancy Pelosi. This is a McConnell shutdown. All he has to do is bring some of the compromising measures that have already been offered to the Senate floor for a vote. If Trump vetoes, they should override that veto. And Andrew in Wisconsin writes, can you address the story that the Trump administration leaked details about Nancy Pelosi's commercial flight to Afghanistan? Is that even legal? Well, the president certainly has control over classified information, but a statement came from Nancy Pelosi's office just a few moments ago. You'll recall, of course, that the president pulled the speaker's Air Force jet and security detail for her trip to Afghanistan. A statement from Nancy Pelosi's spokesman says, in light of the grave threats caused by the president's actions, that's announcing that a trip was planned to Afghanistan and that commercial travel was also a possibility, the delegation has decided to postpone this trip as to not further endanger our troops, security personnel, or other travelers on the flights. That's from Drew Hamill, a Nancy Pelosi spokesperson. So there's the answer to your question, Andrew, that has been addressed in Washington. Now, I promise that we have to hear from one person who's been commenting on the shutdown. She's from the Bronx. Her name is Cardi B, and she's not having it with this government shutdown. Cardi B posted an Instagram video that went viral that had the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and other senators fumbling around, I have to say, on Twitter, wondering if they should retweet Cardi from the Bronx.
Hey, y'all. I just want to remind y'all, because it's been a little bit over 3 weeks, okay? It's been a little bit over 3 weeks. Trump is now ordering, as in summoning, federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid. I know a lot of y'all don't care because y'all don't work for the government or y'all probably don't even have a job, but this is really serious, bro. This is not what I do, but I'm scared.
Now, you might be tempted to think that Cardi B doesn't know much about politics. She does make money move, that's for sure. But Ozma, Cardi B has 40 million Instagram followers, and now a lot of them want to know when this is going to end.
Mm-hmm. And you know what I think is so fascinating, as you were kind of hinting to, Todd, is Cardi B is someone who kind of prides herself on keeping up to date on presidential politics and public policy. You know, this is sort of a quirky aside, but she, you know, a while back made this point that she really loves FDR. And I remember reading about this somewhere. My gosh, it must have been like last year. And she says the reason she loves Franklin D. Roosevelt as a president is she considers him the first Make America Great president because he gave everyone Social Security. So the woman clearly, like, is up to date on her presidential politics and really prides herself on all this. She got millions of views from this video. And she wrote, you know, herself, she was like, what? I'm trending? I didn't know that was going to happen. So I don't know that she had expected the response to this video that she got. But look, it's definitely created, I think, a bit of a somewhat serious but also lighthearted moment to all this. We saw some members of Congress, I think it was Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, debating whether or not he should retweet this. He endorsed the message, but not the some of the words that we had to bleep out there.
Yeah, well, yeah, politicians love attention. I checked YouTube last night, forget about Instagram, 19 million views in just a couple of days for Cardi B. Molly.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the stuff that we talk about in politics sort of stays in the Beltway or is part of an insider conversation and doesn't penetrate. And I think when these kinds of events, like the shutdown, start to be real for most people is when they do cross over into, you know, the realm of pop culture, into the general conversation. And this shutdown now, unlike I think some, perhaps the last shutdown especially, has really crossed over into the broader public consequences. These effects that we're seeing, they're going to be cumulative. And that's the political reality, particularly for the president and the Republicans, who we've seen over and over in public opinion polls are overwhelmingly being blamed by Americans for this. That's going to keep getting worse as the effects keep getting worse.
Well, as we said, these senators were debating last night what they should do with Cardi B's overwhelmingly visible message. But in another corner of Congress, there's been a bit of a sideshow that's moved to the center. I want to talk about Iowa Congressman Steve King, Republican, who was stripped of his committee assignments this week after the New York Times published that Representative King said, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? Steve King wondered. Now, Steve King has a long history of similar remarks. He's uttered ugly caricatures of Latino immigrants on the House floor. He's decried the cultural suicide of America through demographic change and immigration. A lot of this isn't really new from Steve King. So, Molly Ball, the question is, why now? Why was it this that finally caused Steve King's GOP colleagues to sit up, take notice, and turn on him?
It's not clear, frankly, because as you say, this has been a pattern for a long time. I think it's a combination of a couple of things. There is new Republican leadership in the House of Representatives now that they are in the minority and former House Speaker Paul Ryan stepped down. The new minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, was asked, you know, why did it take you so long? And he said, look, I've only been leader for this long. Now, we don't necessarily have evidence that he was in there, you know, lobbying for this to happen before. But it is true that this was a show of force by the new leader, an exertion of control over the caucus to say, this is the kind of thing that I'm not going to tolerate, which I think was surprising to some people because McCarthy is beloved by the members and viewed as quite easygoing. And then I think the second thing is just the overtness of the reference in this particular quote. Now, Steve King claims it was mischaracterized. He says there should have been a new sentence that began with the words Western civilization. That's the only thing he was saying shouldn't be considered an offensive term. Nevertheless, as you say, there's a long pattern of racist comments, and for a very long time, And he's been very influential. Politicians courted his endorsement, particularly presidential contenders in the Iowa caucuses. And Republicans for a long time have been content to just look the other way and pretend it's not happening.
But why a resolution of disapproval, which is a disapproval from the House, which Steve King voted for himself because he said, I don't approve of white nationalism and racism, so I'm voting for this. Why not a censure? Why not one of the strongest rebukes? We could talk about expulsion, I suppose, but not even a censure from the Democrats now who control the majority.
There is further that they could go, and this is as far as they've been willing to go so far. But you do have some members, Democrats and also some Republicans, calling for him to be censured or even expelled.
Asma, I noticed in a report from the Des Moines Register this morning that Steve King is actually using his racist remarks in the aftermath as an opportunity to raise money. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, you mean, look, Steve King has just sort of built, I think, a reputation for a very long time on what I would describe as being white identity politics. And I think that's a really uncomfortable phrase for some people. But we saw Donald Trump capitalize on this during the 2016 election. And we've seen other politicians also embrace this idea. It's something that I think is popular, and it certainly plays to a base. And I hear this from voters when I go out and travel in parts of the country, that there is a feeling of a sense of grievance that white folks are being treated worse than other people, a discomfort with Muslims and Latinos. You know, I've been told this to my face on occasions, and I am not, I should just preface for folks who don't know me, I am Muslim, and so it's sort of an obvious distinction when people see me. And I think that it's something that we have heard time and again from folks, and it's been politically successful in some places. I think, you know, what's interesting to me is there is a moment, I think, of Republican Party concern around what's going on with Steve King right now, and the fact that he is facing a likely primary challenger within his own party will be really interesting to watch. But for a long time, this language has not only been accepted, I would argue that it's been embraced by some members of the party.
We might also point out, not only is Steve King likely facing a primary challenger, but he skated by in the midterms that just passed, almost lost in the general election in a district that Donald Trump won by double digits, and that Steve King, at least in recent history, has had no trouble winning. So he's weak back home, and maybe that, I'd hate to say it, has something to do with Republicans' changed attitudes as well. I want to move on to something taking place here in the Washington area. The wife of the vice president, known now as the second lady, she took a gig teaching art at a school this week. Emmanuel Christian School has policies that ban LGBTQ students from attending and LGBTQ educators from even working there. Now, this caused a great deal of reaction from people, Molly, who thought it just wasn't appropriate for the wife of the vice president or somebody with a prominent role in American politics to work at a private school that had such discriminatory policies.
It did. But I don't think it's particularly surprising or unsettling to supporters of this administration. This has been Mike Pence's brand for a long time, and his wife is a partner in the political enterprise, I think, since the beginning. They are very much, they're devout Christians, and the type of conservative evangelical Christianity that they practice does include this what some would consider exclusionary practice. And so, you know, Mike Pence, when he was the governor of Indiana, famously signed the Religious Freedom Act that many critics said would legalize discrimination, and then he ended up rolling it back in the face of all of this backlash. But you know, this Christian identity has long been part of his politics.
Ozma, I want you to listen to the vice president, Mike Pence. He's come to his wife Karen's defense, saying that attacking her for working at that school is attacking her for being Christian. He gave an interview earlier this week on Eternal World Television Network.
To see major news organizations attacking Christian education is deeply offensive to us. I mean, we have a rich tradition in America of Christian education and, frankly, religious education broadly defined. We celebrate it. It's the freedom of religion is enshrined in the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution prohibits a religious test for holding public office. And so we'll let the critics roll off our back. But this criticism of Christian education in America should stop.
Ozma Khalid, the vice president is deeply offended by the criticism. What about this school? Is there actual discriminatory wording in the policy against LGBTQ people and others?
You know, that I am unclear about in particular. I know this school's been asked to respond to comments from different folks, but my understanding is that the school itself, you know, does sort of have this vision, but beyond that, I don't know too much about in terms of what it actually requires. I think it has some stipulation that applicants have to agree that marriage can only be between a man and a woman.
There's been controversy for months around the U.S. Census, guys. Nearly a year ago, the Commerce Department announced plans to add a controversial question to the 2020 census. The question was, are you a citizen of the United States? Choose yes or no. Well, this week, a federal judge blocked the Trump administration's plans to include that question in the census. And the debate is really not over. The case is likely to wind up in the Supreme Court. Molly Ball, how did we get here? Why did the judge rule this week against adding the citizenship question? Why has it been so controversial for so very long?
Well, it's very complicated, but this has been going on for quite some time, this controversy. And a lot of what has come out has actually revealed that, you know, the way the administration, particularly the Commerce Department, which is in charge of the census, represented what they were trying to do was at odds with what their internal documents show they were actually pursuing. And so the criticism of putting a citizenship, it might seem relatively straightforward thing to ask people, but the concern is, given the controversy in this country over immigration and particularly illegal immigration, and particularly the climate that's been created by this administration and its more aggressive policies toward things like deportation, when you ask, the point of the census is to get an accurate count of how many people are living in America and who they are. But when you ask people a question like this, they have a fear that the government is going to use that then to go after them. And in fact, that they have in other situations used that the disclosure of that information. And so that was the basis, and it has not been asked in the past on the census, and a lot rides on the U.S. Census, everything from congressional representation, the way that districts are counted, to a whole lot of the way that, you know, federal funds are distributed and so on. And so this case has been before the courts for quite a while, and this is a big blow to the administration's efforts to have the court strike it down.
Osmond, Democrats in Congress have been up in arms over Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, and how he's handled this issue of the citizenship question in the census when he's been in front of Congress.
Mm-hmm. And part of this is it goes back to this really big question right around redistricting as well as federal fund dollars. I mean, I think that the census alone seems like a sort of wonky topic, right? It's not something that really generates, I think, a lot of excitement. But the reason it interests so many people and the reason it interests so many Democrats in particular is that there are consequences, specifically when we look at the 10-year census that goes out. And if there is a situation where you have a question about citizenship, there's a concern from Democrats that some of their traditional base voters may be more unlikely to respond, that you have a concern among various minority groups about whether or not there's a sort of trust in government, basic trust in government, and beyond that, whether or not you should fill out the census, specifically if there is a question about whether you're legally here in this country or not.
And Democrats in Congress have said, I believe, that Wilbur Ross wasn't truthful in his testimony about how this decision was made when they decided to put this in the census. So quite apart from the issue of the census, which is constitutionally mandated, and its uses and political advantage, is another issue of truthfulness before Congress, at least according to the House majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this gets into part of what the new House majority has on its plate, which is this tremendous breadth of oversight that they plan to do. The Democrats, having been in the majority in both houses, were relatively powerless to offer any check on the Trump administration for the last 2 years. Now that they have the majority, even with the government down and not functioning, they are able to request witnesses to testify, request documents, issue subpoenas if it comes to that, but that's not the only tool in their arsenal. And this is one of many that you hear. You have the Democrats pointing out that they are not just looking at President Trump himself, his tax returns, Russia, whatever. There is a lot of potential or alleged corruption that has gone on multiple agencies of the executive branch, and they want to look into all of it.
Jose emails, is the question of citizenship a requirement for the questionnaire to be valid? Will the whole thing be invalidated if that question isn't answered? If not, why worry about the question at all? One of the many questions swirling around the 2020 census. I want to go, however, out to Los Angeles. We talked about it a little bit at the top of the show, because for the first time in a little under 30 years, teachers from the LA Unified School District, the public schools there, to represent the second largest school district in the entire nation, went on strike early this week after the school district was unable to reach an agreement with the teachers union, the United Teachers of Los Angeles. They boast more than 30,000 members. And if you saw the pictures, Ozma, many of them were in the streets when the strike was announced, tens of thousands of people. Why are teachers in LA striking now? What's going on?
I mean, my understanding is that there's really a frustration with essentially the class sizes and school staffing as well as higher salaries. And this is not something that is distinctly unique to LA. I mean, it's something that we've seen across the country, I would say, in the last year or so. And it's somewhat turned into a political issue where we even saw some teachers running for office who had never run for political office before in the midterm cycle, or some people who had been really, really outspoken as a result of these strikes. But in LA, it does seem to be coming down to essentially class sizes as well as salaries.
Molly, Ozma raises an interesting point. There have been teacher strikes throughout the last year, year and a half in Colorado, in North Carolina, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky. I think that's the full list, but there may be even more than that. A lot of these protests won significant victories on behalf of teachers and students. And Ozma makes the point that some of the people born of those protests have gotten into politics on the national level. This is not something isolated to LA, even though it is the second largest school district in the entire country.
No, quite the opposite. It appears to be this sort of contagion that is sweeping the country. And, you know, I reported on some of the strikes last year, and I spoke to some of the teachers, and what they talked about in addition to the really terrible conditions that a lot of teachers have found themselves working under, particularly in states that have stripped funds from education for years and years, in a lot of places, you know, education budgets were cut severely when state revenue plummeted after the recession 10 years ago, and then it was just never restored. And that has led to this just ongoing situation where they're barely scraping by on low pay, on large classes, et cetera. But there was also, so the teachers that I spoke to reported this feeling that, you know, we have sat here and taken it for so long and we've sucked it up and we've tried to be good soldiers and we're just not going to take it anymore. And I think as they see their sort of brethren in other states do this, more and more teachers, they, you know, you see a lot of this is grassroots. This happens to be a union that's on strike. But in a lot of these places, it's not the union starting it. It's grassroots groups of teachers who are getting together on Facebook and complaining and sharing their experiences and spontaneously doing these sort of wildcat strikes. And the one other thing that I would connect this to is the rising tide of women's anger in this country. About 3/4 of teachers are female. And although this is not, you know, they don't necessarily portray this as a women's protest, in matter of fact, it really is. And I think that is connected to everything from, you know, the Women's March and the women running for office, a sense particularly among women in America that they are not going to sit on their anger anymore. They're going to do something about it.
The mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, has been pondering a run for president 2020, and that primary field is already starting to get crowded. We're going to talk about that in just a second, Asma. And I wonder if this high-profile strike and tens of thousands of people in the street in Los Angeles is something that Eric Garcetti, Mayor Eric Garcetti, potential presidential candidate, is worrying about.
I mean, I can't imagine that it's something that he isn't worrying about, right? And at this point right now, we're also seeing a flurry of early stage candidates enter the presidential race. And so he, at this point, though, has to deal with the teachers' strike crisis. I mean, this is something that is preoccupying his time. And I spent some time recently both in Iowa and New Hampshire and was talking to folks just about people that they're interested in or they've heard from. And one guy did tell me in Iowa that he was sort of intrigued by Eric Garcetti, but then he hasn't heard from him in a really long time. And at this point, we're beginning to see a lot of other potential candidates be a lot more visible in some of those early primary states.
Well, let's talk about some of them because the list grew this week. The tally's up to 5 interested parties. Elizabeth Warren, Senator of Massachusetts, is in. Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard is in. Former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and retired Army Major Richard Ojeda from West Virginia. Molly, it's only January. I have a very strong feeling that this burgeoning list isn't the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, if Garcetti is sitting on his hands and pondering, he may well end up being too late. I believe it's pronounced Ojeda, and he was actually, to connect all of this, he sort of rose to fame as a state representative for his part in the West Virginia teacher strike. He was one of the ringleaders. But yeah, the field is shaping up, and I think the Garcetti point is really interesting for another reason. As the mayor of Los Angeles, his idea for what he would present that would be attractive to primary and presidential voters is this idea of competence and management. And there's a real question here about what Democrats are looking for in their standard bearer. Are they looking for someone who can say, my contrast to Trump is that I'm no drama. I am not going off on Twitter every day. And what I'm doing is I am competently running a number of city agencies and making things work in this sort of really boring, potentially way. And obviously the strike complicates that case for Garcetti in particular. But then you have, you know, a lot of candidates like an Elizabeth Warren, who is much more about a cause and a policy vision and about, you know, she talks about systemic change. I was with her in Iowa a couple weeks ago, and her argument is that we need to sort of change the very functioning of our entire market system and our democracy in order to make people's lives better. And so the question is, are Democrats going to be looking for someone who they really are with on policy? Are they looking for someone who inspires them? Are they looking for someone who seems competent? Some of the early polling that we're seeing is that the thing that Democrats want more than anything, and this is certainly what I found talking to voters, is just somebody who can beat Trump. The problem is they're not sure what that is.
Asma Khalid, Democrats seem to do well in the midterms by effectively ignoring Trump, at least in most races, and just running on that competence or that alternative that Molly's talking about. And I wonder if you have a sense from your travels in Iowa and New Hampshire or other places about this field and about what kind of Democratic candidate, Democratic primary voters, not general election voters, mm-hmm. might be looking for.
Yeah, I mean, you're right in pointing out that the midterms, we saw a lot of really successful candidates focus more specifically, let's say, on healthcare as a public policy than on necessarily constantly talking about Trump. I think that this cycle will be a little bit different for a couple of reasons. And one is to echo what Molly said. Everywhere I have gone since after the election, the most consistent thing I have heard from voters is they are wanting somebody who can beat Donald Trump. It is singularly the most common thing you hear from somebody. What that means exactly, I do think, is a little unclear. Some people talked to me about wanting a candidate who's authentic. They did not feel, many of them, that Hillary Clinton gave off a vibe of authenticity during the 2016 election cycle. Some of them are also looking for competency. They really don't feel like they have a competent president in Donald Trump. And then lastly, I would say some of them are just also looking for a person that they feel that they trust. And I think that that's a little bit difficult to decipher what all these things mean, because they want somebody, they say, who is willing to fight back against Donald Trump. They want somebody who is not necessarily going to fight back against him in the same way, but they want someone who is willing to stand up to him. And so as a result, I think the idea of not talking about Trump is just something not really viable. But, you know, look, who knows? We'll see as we go on, I think, during this primary calendar, how different candidates approach Donald Trump. What I was really intrigued by, I was also with Senator Warren out in Iowa, is she very rarely, if at all, mentioned Donald Trump. I believe she was asked a question about him. But her standard campaign stump speech has nothing to do with Donald Trump. It's all about her economic policy, her vision for bringing up the middle class. And that's what I've heard from so far a lot of candidates, though we did see Kirsten Gillibrand really talk rather, I would say, candidly about the threat that she saw Donald Trump pose to kind of the moral fabric of this country. And as more candidates enter the race, I think we are going to see kind of a split in how they feel they should talk about the president.
Other names waiting in the wings that we haven't mentioned that I think we're going to talk about a lot in the near future: Molly Ball, Bernie Sanders, of course, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris. The list could go on rather than just this original five or six who are already in.
Well, what was the other thing that we saw that Democratic voters were looking for in the midterms? It was women. A huge number of women candidates won their primaries. There was a sense that the base was explicitly looking for women candidates as a sort of strike of resistance against Trump. A large part of the Democratic base is women. And you see a lot of the women candidates being the first to jump into this pool. At the same time, there's an uneasiness because of the Hillary hangover. And there is this conversation, people kind of having it quietly in hushed tones, not sure if they can say it out loud. It's a little bit un-PC. But there is this question, given what happened to Hillary and the sense that a lot of Democrats feel deeply that sexism was a part of what held Hillary Clinton back, can a woman win? Is it safe for the party to nominate a woman if that's going to decrease their chances of winning against Trump? And so I think the reason a lot of the female candidates are jumping into the pool first is to try to defuse that. And you had Warren herself explicitly holding an event where she brought on stage a bunch of 2018 female candidates to talk about what a strength it was to run as a woman in this day and age, explicitly trying to take on that perception.
Well, a couple of listeners have gotten in touch in the last few minutes with us to take exception with some of the conversation we've been having, especially about Mike Pence and Karen Pence and her employment at a conservative Christian school in Virginia. David writes, please be sensitive with your language in characterizing VP Pence as representing Christianity in total. He does not. There are millions of Christians who believe that Jesus's message of love and compassion is meant for all, no exceptions. And Deb tweets, I'm cringing listening to your guest. She seems to be defending the Christian thought of being anti-LGBTQ. Not true. And Steve King's brand of white nationalism because it's working for him in his district. Very concerning in America, but I'm not hearing that in your voices, Molly.
Well, you know, I don't think either of us, either Asma or I, meant to defend that point of view, but merely to report on it and to describe it. No, certainly there are many, many, many kinds of Christianity that are practiced, but it is the one that is practiced by Mike and Karen Pence that they view as demanding this particular view toward the LGBTQ community. And there are obviously many Christians who do not feel that way, but the issue that that the Pences see as an issue of religious freedom is whether you are allowed to pursue the type of religion that you practice in the way that you see fit, even if that means excluding some people.
And I just want to clarify one thing, too, on that front. You know, we talked earlier about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that Mike Pence introduced in the state of Indiana. He was the governor there at the time. I mean, Indiana is one of the more Christian states. If you sort of look at surveys from, you know, even the Pew Research Center, it's hard to find out exact religious identity. And that Religious Freedom Restoration Act was rather unpopular even among some members of the Republican Party. So I do agree with this idea that, you know, yes, there are distinctions within people who do subscribe to Christianity, whether or not they agree with this viewpoint that that Mike Pence and his wife espouse. It was not necessarily popular, and you saw signs up throughout the state of Indiana saying to essentially repeal Pence. This is before he had been brought in as Donald Trump's VP candidate.
Well, I'm glad we got listeners in on that discussion, and I'm glad Asma and Molly, you both had a chance to respond. I want to touch on one other little piece of news, and it was branding news. It was Gillette Razors who jumped into some of the social debates in this country and probably made a lot of money doing it by airing an ad, basically that a lot of people on the conservative side, I would say, made them feel painted into a corner, talking about toxic masculinity, talking about the boys of today who become the men of tomorrow. It caused a great deal of controversy, which is what any brand would like. I think 10 million views on YouTube for that ad. Molly, what exactly do you think Gillette was trying to get at here, and did they succeed?
I don't know if we'll know whether they succeeded until we see, you know, how many units they moved, how
sales
many razors
figures
they sold. That's, of course, obviously the point of any commercial ad campaign, not to create social change or make people feel good. It's to sell razors. And, you know, they certainly succeeded in getting people talking. I am skeptical of the degree to which this is a giant controversy among real people versus just, you know, some random people on Twitter and maybe a couple of commentators who have decided to read something into this. But it is true that when you can stage a provocation like this, and I'm sure they knew that this was going to provoke some people, you get people talking, you get more attention for your company. The other thing I would connect this to is there was a new survey from Pew this week about the politics of Generation Z, the generation that's following the millennials, and they are quite progressive when it comes to particularly attitudes toward race and gender. And so I think you saw this also with the Nike campaign with Colin Kaepernick, that companies feel like this is the direction where they can particularly connect with young people.
Well, before we go for the hour, I want to end on a note of news. We have to talk about Muhammad Ali, the greatest of all time. That legendary boxer, he might have floated like a butterfly, but when it came to actual flying, he was a little less than thrilled. Here's the champ in a 1970 interview describing his, quote, real fear, the flight, not the fight.
The only thing scared me is when I'm in a jet and the lady says, ladies and gentlemen, we've just been informed by the pilot that we are coming into a thunderstorm. And then I see the steward's eyes big, and I see the lightning in the dark cloud, and all of a sudden, bam, the plane starts shaking and wings flopping. And I think about the plane splitting and the long fall, and I say, why did I have to rush? I could have took a bus. Oh, Lord, if you just let me off of here, I'll take a train the next time. But that time, boom, planes get to shaking and falling. And I say, if I get off this plane, I'll whoop any man in the world.
God, I could listen to him all day long. Maybe a little bit ironic then that the latest posthumous honor given to the champ, they're naming the airport in Louisville, his hometown, after him. Now, they're not changing the airport code. It's going to stay SDF. I want to say they could have made it a GOAT, greatest of all time, or maybe just greatest. Look, I want to thank my guest, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time and CNN, and Asma Khalid of NPR. Thanks to you both. And we're leaving you with a little bit of my shot from the musical Hamilton. It opened this week in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Lin-Manuel Miranda of Puerto Rico gave an honor.
We'll turn to international news on the Friday News Roundup right after this. We're gonna rise up, rise up. It's time to take a shot. Rise up, rise up. It's time to take a shot. Rise up. It's time to take a shot. Rise up. Take a shot. Shot. Shot.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's is the everyday flat for life on the go that comes in four fashionable styles for women: the flat, the point, the loafer, and the sneaker. Fun designs and patterns while still looking polished and professional, with new colors launched every few weeks. Best of all, Rothy's are made from recycled plastic water bottles and completely machine washable, so you can feel good about wearing them. Go to Rothy's.com and enter code 1A to get your flats and free shipping.
We take most things for granted, like our morning coffee, but there are a lot of people behind that cup of coffee, and A.J. Jacobs set out to thank all of them.
It doesn't just take a village to make a cup of coffee, it takes the world.
Ideas around appreciation on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Terrorism rocked Kenya and Syria and took lives in both of those countries this week. There were desperate moves in the UK to try and reach a deal before the clock runs out on Brexit, and at least one act of kindness from one continental neighbor to another. It's our weekly tradition to round up some of the biggest international headlines on Friday, so let's keep with that custom and head around the world with Jennifer Williams. She's foreign editor at Vox and co-host of its foreign affairs podcast called Worldly. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey.
Great to have you. John Sopel is here. He's BBC's North American editor and author, If Only They Didn't Speak English, Notes from Trump's America. John, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nancy Youssef is also here. She's national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Great to see you again, Nancy.
Great to be with you.
I want to start with my guests, however, in Syria this week, guys, where a terrorist attack where ISIS has claimed responsibility has been deadly. At least 14 people were killed Wednesday in an explosion in a small but crowded alley of shops. Later the same day, the vice president, Mike Pence, gave a State Department conference and addressed the crowd and said this.
Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners. And we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled and ISIS has been defeated.
Caliphate has crumbled, ISIS has been defeated, says the vice president on the very same day that four Americans were killed in Syria. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been traveling to Middle Eastern countries to ease concerns about the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. Nancy Youssef, there were four Americans killed in that attack, as I mentioned on Wednesday. What do we know?
So these Americans, there were two U.S. service members, a contractor and a civilian were meeting at a restaurant that Americans frequently visited when they went to the northern city of Manbij, because this was a city that was liberated from ISIS control in 2016. And during congressional delegation visits or visits by commanders, you would see Americans going to this restaurant. It was really sort of seen as a business that really exemplified the fact that ISIS was no longer in control of that city, that the, and that Syrians were rebuilding their community. And so they were holding a meeting there when a suicide bomber went in and detonated himself. And the U.S. has announced the names of three of the four because one of them did not work for the U.S. military or the Department of Defense. Their name was not announced. A couple things that sort of have emerged from this, arguably, there had been concerns about sleeper cells within Manbij, and obviously this confirmed it. The U.S. military initial assessment is that ISIS was indeed responsible and that the Americans were the target of this attack. And so the question becomes, how expansive is the sleeper cell network in cities like Manbij? And for the U.S. military, I think there are questions about how do they conduct themselves in terms of how do they protect their security. Normally in the military, does it repeat patterns? And yet in places like Manbij and Raqqa, they frequently would go to the same places and meet with the same people and develop a pattern of life that arguably put them in harm's way.
Now, Jennifer, this comes at a time, of course, when President Trump says he is pulling U.S. troops out of Syria. The vice president reiterated it in that clip that I played, negotiating with allies about a post-U.S. future for Kurds and others.
others in Syria. Is there any reason to believe that, this apparent ISIS attack, the timing of it, is related to the fact that we publicized that we're leaving? Maybe ISIS, the remnants of it, or how much of ISIS is operating in Syria, saying, no, you're not?
Right. And that remains kind of the big question. You know, again, as Nancy said, this is a place that was, you know, known to be frequented by Americans. So there is obviously the possibility that it was just something that was long in the works, or that something that became essentially, you know, something that you just did because they were there, an act of opportunity. But the fact that it does come right at this really critical time when even U.S. allies and adversaries are trying to figure out, and even the administration itself, I would say, trying to figure out what the policy really is going to be going forward with respect to Syria. And I think it raises some questions, right? So, you know, if ISIS did this, right, well, did they do it because they want to convince Trump, see, you really should get out? Like, we, you know, we're still here, but it's scary. You don't want American troops to continue to get killed, which is one of the arguments he said, right? He said both, one, that ISIS is defeated, but also, two, that we should let our allies, we should let Turkey handle this. And we don't need to be putting U.S. troops in danger anymore. So was that the, you know, if this was planned in this respect, was that the intention? Or was it more, well, we want to keep you here? And I think even ISIS experts are divided among themselves about what ISIS would even want and why would they want them to stay? Do they want to bring America back in and make this kind of an all-out apocalyptic war of all for all? Or, you know, was it trying to convince Trump that really get out now?
John Sopel, what about the Secretary of State's trip around the Middle East, reassuring allies, trying to negotiate with them about what a U.S. exit from Syria will look like? What's on the table and what's the concern? Because we have allies on the ground in northern Syria, the Kurds, who very much fear our NATO ally Turkey should the U.S. pull out.
Of course. And you also have the British, the French, other countries involved who are fighting alongside the Americans and have been, and who were totally blindsided when the president suddenly said, we're pulling out of Syria. And it made Mike Pompeo's job that much more difficult when he went there, not just because of what the president had said, but, I mean, you know, there was the tweet from the president that if you do anything against the Kurds, we're going to cripple the Turkish economy. And that was the only one moment on the trip where Pompeo seemed sort of destabilized slashed angry. And when asked about what that meant, he said, well, you're going to have to speak to the White House about that. He didn't want to go there. I think his task has been made more difficult. Look, this was a big set piece occasion when Pompeo was hoping to rally the Gulf nations and Israel into kind of some kind of axis against Iran. And it has been made more complicated by what the president has done, saying, right, we're out of here. And I think that kind of find a forge a way through this has become more difficult.
I think one of the challenges for people following the withdrawal from Syria is in the past, the deliberations would happen and the details would be worked out behind closed doors, right? The options would be presented within the administration. The consequences of those actions would be debated internally, and then the announcement would be made. Where in this case, the announcement was made first, and now everybody's sort of watching that debate happen in terms of how to execute that announcement, the announcement being the withdrawal of all of the more than 2,000 U.S. troops in a matter of months. And so I think that's one of the challenges that makes following this so difficult, is you're hearing plans and then maybe they're being revised publicly. And so it makes, I think, for allies and for Americans alike, a difficult challenge to try to follow precisely what the withdrawal plan will look like and what the U.S. hopes to achieve through it.
Confusion reigns as American foreign policy is filtered through the Twitter account and the pronouncements of the commander-in-chief alone, it seems, occasionally the vice president, but not much more of the national security apparatus. Let me move us to Africa and to Kenya, where a horrific terrorist attack killed 21 people, confirmed dead. The attack at a hotel in Nairobi lasted 19 hours. More people were injured, and some people are still unaccounted for. One of the victims was American Jason Spindler, a 9/11 survivor. Jennifer, do we know who was behind this attack, what it was all about, what the motivation was?
Well, so Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for it, and there was really no question, you know, when the attack first happened. As someone who previously, before I was a journalist, I did counterterrorism studies, and, you know, as soon as I heard the attack, it's pretty clear that this is something that al-Shabaab likes to pull off. You know, they recently did, back in 2013, the Westgate Mall attack in Kenya. They've been waging a war, both an insurgency inside Somalia and of war kind of externally against the countries, including Kenya, who have sent forces in to kind of fight against them for years now. And so this is the kind of thing that we would expect to see from them. The question, I think, for a lot of people, and including the U.S. military, is, you know, the U.S. military just recently announced they're going to start doing a drawdown of some of the forces that they have in Somalia. A lot of Americans probably don't even realize that U.S. troops are in Somalia, waging a campaign not only just against al-Shabaab, but also helping the Somali forces and the regional governments, including the Kenyans, kind of train their forces and figure out a way to be better at fighting al-Shabaab. But they've been doing this for years. And the fact that al-Shabaab is able to come back in and do such a dramatic, spectacular attack after all these years of the U.S. military being there and training and developing these forces raises a really big question of, you know, what have they been doing? Is this something, you know, are they not nearly as degraded as we thought? And does that change the plans for U.S. military drawdown?
John Sopel, the way Jennifer describes it reminds me of our discussion we just had in Syria. American forces in an area of influence pulling back, local Islamic terrorist groups flexing whatever muscles they have to show that there will be repercussions once the Americans are gone.
Of course, and it shows that you can, you don't need very many people. It was obviously that they had recce'd where they were going to attack. There was film of them days before going to the same place. It's slightly personal for me because 5.5 years ago, I was on a big anniversary when the Westgate Mall incident happened, and I abandoned my wife and put on a flak jacket and ended up outside the Westgate Mall reporting on that. Look, al-Shabaab find it very easy to drift across the border, to launch an attack, and any signs that they get of weakness, whether it's American forces withdrawing. It was interesting that there was a British SAS officer who was there, who was kind of doing, getting some provisions or something when this attack started a few days ago, and kind of went in and started rescuing people. You know, the British Special Forces, American Special Forces are have been very committed to helping build Kenyan resilience. But it doesn't, you know, you just find a small chink of armor, and whether you are an ISIS terrorist or whether you're al-Shabaab, it doesn't take much to exploit that. And it does show that you cannot protect yourself 100% against the threat of terror attacks, even if you commit huge amounts of resources.
We got one comment from Mercy, who tweeted, "Yesterday, over 20 people were killed and many more were injured in a suicide bombing in Colombia. No one even cares in the United States." We should note, since we were talking about terrorism in Syria and in Nairobi, that that attack in Colombia that Mercy's talking about was targeted at the Bogota Police Academy. At least 21 people were killed. It's the deadliest attack in Colombia in over a decade. I want to take us to Poland, where there was some other tragic news this week. In an increasingly politically polarized Poland, the mayor of the city of Gdańsk, the home of the Solidarity movement of the 1980s, his name is Paweł Adamowicz, and he was fatally stabbed at a public charity event on Sunday. He died the following day. He was 53 years old. Adamowicz served as mayor since 1998. Jennifer, what do we know about the mayor of Gdańsk, and what did he stand for? What did he believe in? And do we have any idea why he may have been targeted?
Right. Well, so a lot of the confusion right now is about the perpetrator, the suspected perpetrator, there's footage of him running on stage and doing this, so it's pretty clear who did this. It seems that he was mentally ill, that he may have had grievances about being put in prison. So, you know, and he expressed that in the video. There's footage. It's horrific. So warning, if you ever try to go see it, you know, he's pacing back and forth on stage. He's holding this, you know, huge 6-inch knife aloft and, you know, grabs the microphone, is kind of yelling and talking about, you know, all of his grievances and things. But, you know, it sparked this kind of broader conversation about, you know, the level of vitriol in politics there in the region and in Gdansk in particular, but in Poland. And it's kind of, a lot of people are looking at this as, you know, part of this broader kind of question of whether politics has gotten too ugly, too vicious. And I think it really echoes in a lot of ways some of the other kind of killings we've seen with Joe Cox in the UK, sparking that same kind of you know, awareness that what if things have gotten too far, that even if the actual act itself may have been, you know, driven by someone who is mentally ill and not directly connected to politics, is this kind of atmosphere, same thing with the killing here, rather the shooting of Gabby Giffords, it sparked that kind of conversation conversation about whether, you know, we need to stop and have this kind of rethinking of what we're doing in political kind of language.
Nancy Youssef, Poland has gone through a lot of spasms in the last couple of years, vilification of the media, marginalizing of the judiciary, a lot of similar political reactions that we've seen across Europe, as Jennifer mentions, and some of them not terribly unsimilar to what we've seen in the United States as well.
That's right. But to that point of this conversation that it's led to, I think on one hand we've seen such a heartwarming response to this mayor's death, and at the same time we've seen those very polarized positions almost harden in the discourse in Poland about the circumstances behind his death. The right has said this is the left turning this into a political debate when it was really about somebody who was mentally unstable, and the left is saying that this demands a broader conversation. And so while I think we've seen similar discussions across Europe, so far in Poland, this has not been something that has really broken the divisive of politics that have become so defining there.
Let's spend some time now with Brexit. I feel we must. It has been, John is already face-palming.
Head in hands, how did Britain get itself into such a mess?
Now, hold on, because you've been wondering this for a long time, John. Let me bring people up to date, because I am going to turn to you, since you're our resident Brexit expert, and you've been here before. We're going to get to that as well. Now, the UK, guys, gritted its teeth through two monumental votes this week. The first one saw the Prime Minister, Theresa May's Brexit plan, go down in flames, and that sounded like this.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock!
That's the Speaker on the floor of the House of Commons in London. The second vote saw Theresa May's career emerge once again from the ashes.
The ayes to the right, 306. The noes to the left, 325. Yeah!
The House of Commons votes no on no confidence for Theresa May. That means that she stays in power. Significantly weakened, however, the Prime Minister has been working on her plan for the UK to leave the EU for 2.5 years, and this week it suffered the most devastating defeat the House of Commons has seen in a century. Now, John, I turn to you. The last time you were here on 1A, you had a string of adjectives for this story. Let's go back in time for just a moment and listen to what John Sopel had to say about Brexit not so long ago.
It is migraine-inducingly complex what the British government is setting out on.
John Sopel of the BBC, migraine-inducingly complex. How is your headache now, my friend?
Not got any better. What we have at the moment in Westminster, in British political life, is that there is a majority against everything and no majority for anything. So that people can agree on what they disagree on, but no one can agree on what they agree on. And so you've got at the moment Theresa May's proposal. That absolutely led to the biggest defeat that a governing party has ever seen in the House of Commons. I mean, and so everything that she's worked for 2 years crumbled before her. There are those people who want a second referendum so that this should go back to the British people. That doesn't command a majority. And there are those people who are ready to countenance a hard Brexit because they think that any deal that is on offer from the European Union isn't good enough. That has no majority. So Theresa May is going to come back and make a statement next Monday. There's going to be another vote on what I'm not sure on the 29th of January, with great synchronicity, the same day as should have been the State of the Union. And maybe we could do a compare and contrast about the two relative states of a closed government here and what's happening in Britain with Brexit. And meanwhile, the clock is ticking towards the March the 29th, which is when a law has been passed that Britain will leave the European Union. I don't see how we get to that point. I think, and you can play it back the next time if you ever invite me back on again, where my prediction comes completely wrong, is that what they'll have to do is at some point she's going to have to say, there is no majority for anything. We are going to temporarily rescind the moving of Article 50. Let me put that into ordinary English. Article 50 is the method by which we leave the European Union. She's going to put our departure on hold. For a month, for 6 months, for a year, for 2 years, I do not know.
Isn't that just a de facto
kicking the can down the road?
Or the second referendum that people talk about, you say there is no majority, but that would be, in effect, pulling it all back and putting a stop to this.
What could get a majority in the House of Commons is an even softer Brexit than the one she is proposing. So what they call a Norway deal, which is whereby we are still in the single market. There is still the free movement of people and goods. We are not, we don't have any say in the rules of the European Union, but we're still sort of governed by them. That could get a majority, actually. But it would tear the Conservative Party to pieces. And the Conservative Party, I think, would fracture into little pieces between the kind of Eurosceptics who want no compromise with Brussels and the rest. And I think that she'll want to avoid that as well. There are no good options.
Jennifer Williams, how is anyone doing business in the UK right now? I mean, the old saw is that businesses love only one thing besides profit. They love predictability. There is none to be had in all of the UK right now because, let's face it, a huge amount of their business is on the continent, relies on the EU, and I don't see how anybody is making any plans.
Yeah, they're basically making contingency plans, a worst-case scenario, all hell is going to break loose plans. So basically assume the worst and plan for that. You even have, you know, the government planning to, you know, deploy troops to the border, you know, the Irish border to make sure that in case unrest breaks out there, that they're prepared. You know, and going to the point earlier about, you know, what Theresa May is going to potentially present on Monday, you know, this kind of has to do with the fact that going into this vote, she was essentially playing hardball, saying it's my plan or nothing. There is no plan B. There is no other option. And now she has to come and present her plan B. So I think we're going to find out whether that was bluster and she does have a plan B, or whether she takes plan A, scribbles out the title and writes plan B on top of it and says, here's my new plan B. It happens to be also plan A.
Nancy Youssef, some leaders make a plan B, some are born with it, and some have plan B thrust upon them. And it would seem, according to Jennifer Williams, that that's the situation that Theresa May finds herself in.
Well, and I find so fascinating this idea of a second referendum that we've sort of really heard take off in terms of a possible solution this week, given the lack of options. And this is sort of my own American eye to it. I think one of the takeaways, arguably, from all this is that maybe referendums aren't the best way to solve complex problems, that complex problems demand the deliberative process of an elected body. And so I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing this reticence to say a second referendum. If you had a second referendum, what would it say? Who would decide what it says? What happens if it votes for Brexit again? And what does it mean to a population when you're saying to them, the referendum of last time, we're going to bring it back to the people because we, the elected officials, cannot come up with the solutions to the complex problems for which you've voted us to tackle. And so I think it's an interesting discussion that this all raises about referendums, particularly in places like California, in this country, where referendums are so actively deployed.
We got this question from Dave on the very question of Brexit, who says, I thought that Theresa May herself called for a vote of no confidence in her government in the past couple of months and won that vote, thereby preventing members of the House of Commons from bringing a no confidence vote for the subsequent year. Now, given the vote taken in the past few months, the one called for by May herself, why was the recent vote allowed to be requested and allowed to be taken at all, John Sobel?
Oh, we're getting into the weeds of British politics.
Why not?
Loving it. What happened, the first confidence vote, was her own members of Parliament, the Conservative Party. They tried to put down a motion of no confidence. There's this thing called the 1922 Committee, which is all the backbench Conservative MPs, people who are just kind of the voting fodder, that go through the lobbies and vote for government proposals, except they don't anymore. And 100 of them voted against her. It means that within the Conservative Party, within her own party, within her own caucus, she cannot be challenged for a year. What happened the other night at Westminster on Wednesday night was that it was a vote of confidence by Parliament. And that is where, so all of a sudden, all these Conservative MPs who'd voted for her demise and that she should be replaced then voted for her. Because what the Conservative Party is terrified of is a general election and the left-wing Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, becoming Prime Minister. And going back to Nancy's point about the referendum, I mean, there is a really difficult question. Is it a one-part question? Is it either or? Or is it a three-part question? Do you say, do you want to remain in the European Union? Do you want Theresa May's May's deal, or do you want a hard Brexit? And if you have a three-part question on a referendum, what is the voting system by which you judge who's got a majority? It is fiendishly, dare I say, migraine-inducingly complex.
Double down is
double down. I'm not backing down from that phrase.
Well, look, here's my question. I get that a referendum might be mind-numbingly migraine-inducingly complex as well, but what would the answer be right now today if the British public were asked Brexit, yes or no? Is there national regret? Is there national sense of, please let us do this over? If I were to put that to the question, the British public, would they vote to stop all this?
I don't think, I mean, there are some people who've changed. It does look like the polls have shifted a bit towards people thinking that Brexit might not be this kind of dream of a wonderful life just round the corner and it's all going to be so easy, which is how it was presented 2.5 years ago. I think people have come to that realization, and so maybe that has changed. More young people would go to vote. That all points to people thinking maybe we would vote to remain. I'll just give you one very quick anecdote. In 1997, when Tony Blair won his landslide election victory, I lived in a constituency, a parliamentary district called Winchester, just south of London. And the Liberal Democrat won it by 2 votes out of an electorate of 80,000. The Conservative who lost took it to the High Court and said this result should be overturned and the election should be rerun. He won his case in the High Court. It was rerun. And the Liberal Democrat this time won with a majority of 21,000.
A lot of people who sat it out the first time said, I better get on it.
And or people who felt that their sense of fair play had been offended. And there might be a very big backlash saying, hang on, we've made our decision. We voted for Brexit. And I may not have liked it the first time, but that was right. It's only just that you deliver Brexit. And I think there could be a very big backlash from the British people if this question was tried to be put again.
Jennifer, you mentioned contingency plans by British business owners, worst case scenario. France has already activated a contingency plan in the case that the UK leaves the EU with no deal. But quickly, what would a no deal Brexit mean for the UK? Does anybody have their head around that?
Well, I mean, you've seen some disaster scenarios, you know, planes being stopped on the tarmac because, you know, the air traffic controllers and the rules that govern international air travel were suddenly in question. I've even heard, you know, there have been people talking about doctors, physicians in surgery who were accredited under EU rules now suddenly not being able to know if they're even accredited to continue operating in the UK. Even things like, you know, the availability of food, people stockpiling food. I think a lot of this is probably, hopefully, I would say, slightly overblown in the sense that, you know, it is also possible to just say we're going to continue to use these rules until we have a solution. But it's not going to be pretty for anyone, politically, socially, or economically.
Well, just ahead, more of the Friday News Roundup. We'll talk China. We'll talk Russia. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
This week on Ask Me Another, we've got TV's favorite muscle man, Terry Crews from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And he chats about his multiple talents and how he stays humble in Hollywood. It's dropping in your feeds Friday, January 18th on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Let's go to Russia, gang, because the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, said on Wednesday that Russia is not happy about Britain's chaotic departure from the EU. John Sopel, Sergei Lavrov says he's disappointed to see what we've been talking about, what Theresa May and the rest of the British public is going through with Brexit. You don't look like you buy it.
I think they may be crocodile tears. I mean, you know, Russia stands to gain the more disunited that Europe is. And that is why it has supported the populist parties, whether it be the Front National in France, its intervention in the US presidential election to sow discord and discontent, involvement in the EU referendum campaign. You know, the more united that Europe is, the more united that NATO is, the more that makes life difficult for the Russians. So I kind of think that, you know, in London, at Westminster, given all the problems that they have at the moment, I think that the intervention of Sergei Lavrov will not be ever so welcome.
Nancy,
he says with British understatement.
Indeed. And thank you for pointing up the understatement.
Sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes it does.
Miss it, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Helps us Americans latch on. I appreciate it. Nancy Youssef, meanwhile, the New York Times reported last Friday, we all know this now, that after President Trump fired James Comey, the FBI director, that the FBI began investigating whether Donald Trump had been working on behalf of Russia, whether knowingly or unknowingly. Sergei Lavrov was asked about that. He dismissed it, of course. But tell us about his take on the potential of the president being some kind of Russian asset.
Well, and his foreign policy aide called it stupid and used other colorful language. Now, perhaps I've watched too many all the president's men too many times, but one could argue that there were a lot of non-denial denials, that they were very sort of colorful in their language, but not specific. And now if one is in Russia's position, they have no reason to sort of make a declarative clarifying statement that this sort of uncertainty and questions that surround the Trump administration work to their benefit. And I think you saw that they sort of fed into that was some of this language where they used a lot of adjectives and names to sort of to say nothing of the sort it was possible, but stop short of offering any sort of declarative statements that would seek to bring more stability or take away some of the uncertainty around all these issues.
Jennifer.
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying that don't believe anything until the Kremlin denies it, which I think in this case is really spot on. You know, Vladimir Putin himself in particular and his government lackeys, for lack of a better word, are very good at what I kind of call implausible deniability, where it's a sort of wink and a nod, where they're, you know, kind of sort of, oh, of course, you know, almost over the top, but we could never do something like that, when you're like, of course you absolutely could, and of course you absolutely, you know, would see a benefit out of this. You know, we also saw reports out this week, speaking of NATO, you know, that President Trump had, you know, gone way further than we had previously known publicly in calling for the U.S. to actually pull out of NATO. And if you want to talk about something that Vladimir Putin's Russia would really love to see, the U.S. breaking up NATO, I mean, that's like the best Christmas present ever for Putin. So, you know, whether or not Trump is, you know, accidentally or just by happenstance in line with Russia's kind of desires on NATO, or whether there's something more sinister, as, you know, increasing evidence seems to lean toward, we don't know obviously at all yet. Either way, Vladimir Putin is certainly getting what he wants.
Jennifer, let's stay in the neighborhood for just a moment because I want to talk about Chechnya. Life is very difficult. Life in some ways is awful for LGBTQ people in Chechnya. We saw more signs of that this week. Around 40 people have been detained, another two killed in the latest crackdown on the LGBTQ community in Chechnya. Now, Chechnya is predominantly Muslim republic in Russia. Tell us more about what's gone on this week and what a little bit about the background is.
Right. So this is kind of, once again, this purge that we saw previously in previous years. And it's absolutely just horrific. And it's part of this kind of broader kind of anti-LGBTQ push that you see not just in Chechnya, but also in kind of Russia more generally. And Vladimir Putin himself has, you know, banned talking about, protesting about anything like that. Part of the, what he likes to term like the homosexual agenda, right? Anything that could push that that narrative forward. And in Chechnya, you see what that kind of policy turns into when it's taken to its extreme, when you're taken to actually rounding up people who either are LGBT or are just suspected of being LGBT, or maybe someone has a grudge against them and is just saying that they are, right? That's the problem with things like this, is that this isn't something that you can, you know, prove, or that, you know, it's just you can round up anyone. And so, you know, it's part of this kind of horrific anti-LGBT crackdown that we've seen taken out to the most brutal extremes.
And people have been disappeared there. Nancy Youssef, authorities in Chechnya have denied these charges that I just listed, but its leadership has also told reporters as recently as 2017 that gay people simply do not exist.
That's right, in their country. That's right. You know, and one of the reason we've seen in the past these sort of purges is sort of a precipitating event that sort that opens up their exposure to members of the gay community in Chechnya. In this case, there was an administrator of a website who was arrested, and so they went through his phone and got other people's names and contact information. That's believed to be what sort of triggered this latest purge in Chechnya. And so you've seen members of the LGBTQ community coming out and saying delete contacts on your phones, delete apps, delete anything to kind of give any sort of indication of your sexual orientation to the government. The other interesting thing that we've seen is an exploitation there of sort of the anti-gay sentiment by telling family members, in some cases, we're going to let you handle it. The understanding being that that you deal with it internally, the assumption of a shame associated with being gay and suggesting honor killings and other forms of punishments within families. And so I think the real big takeaway is the reason this is allowed to happen is that Moscow has not done anything to signal or tell the government that this is unacceptable behavior. And so I think we'll continue to see these purges and only learn about them through groups that are sort of furtively operating to try to expose this to the world community.
Indeed, the signaling from Moscow and Vladimir Putin's government, at least in years past, has been decidedly for discrimination against LGBTQ people. There are crackdowns in Russia proper all the time. There have been reports of, you know, one gay pride parade being allowed, but with police on the fringes, and many, many crackdowns in the past, John.
Yes, some of Putin's obvious supporters, the biker gangs, going in to show what they think about some of the gay people that are marching, and while the police stand back a little bit and allow them to be roughed up. It's from the, as with everything in Russia, the message comes down pretty much from the top. Putin is in tune with what a lot of people think in America. He presents himself as this macho, bare-chested hero who goes out fishing, who rides horses, who, you know, wrestles bears. I mean, everything about the sort of imagery in Russia is anti-gay. And so, you know, maybe in St. Petersburg, you can perhaps lead a fairly normal life if you're gay. Maybe in parts of Moscow, you can. But I would think in the rest of Russia, life would be pretty difficult for you to be openly homosexual or, you know, part of the LGBTQ community.
Let me move us to China before the hour is out, because there's been major news from China and China's relationship with Canada. A Canadian man named Robert Lloyd Schellenberg has been sentenced to death by a Chinese court on accounts of drug smuggling. Now, this comes at a time when the two countries are having a lot of tension in their relations over the last month. A Canadian arrest of Meng Wanzhou, a famous tech CFO in Canada, Jennifer Williams. The Schellenberg case, what are the charges? And then we're going to talk a little bit about the broader tensions between these two countries.
Sure, right. So in this case, it looks like it's essentially part of that broader kind of issue, right? So we have just continuing to see Canadians who are being picked up on spurious charges of, you know, spying or, you know, various other things related to, you know, business, you know, misconduct or all kinds of different things, where the charges themselves are kind of beside the point. And the fact of the actual arrest and the fact they are holding Canadian citizens seems to be the actual point. And the point being that, okay, fine, if you're going to pick up our citizens and you're going to, you know, especially a citizen as prominent as, you know, CFO of a major international tech company, Huawei, you're going to suffer repercussions. Like, we are not going to accept this, and we will play this tit for tat game. And you pick up one of ours, we'll pick up what, six of yours, you know, more and more. So you're seeing this kind of hardball game that they're playing. And, you know, the question then becomes, what does Canada do, right? Do they, you know, decide to, okay, fine, you know, obviously we want to protect our citizens, we're going to give in and not maybe extradite the CFO to the U.S. has been requested, or whether they, you know, continue to stand up and say, no, this is the rule of law, this is what we're going to do, and we won't give in. And I think it's just also, I think, brought attention to the kind of broader tensions about, you know, China and its trade practices and, you know, the kind of trade war going on between the U.S. and China. This is kind of causing additional kind of chaos and bumps in the road as they're trying to negotiate trade deals. And so, you know, it's definitely something that seems to be escalating.
Nancy Youssef, not just tit for tat arrests and holding of citizens, as Jennifer describes, but escalation of the sentence, it seems, in this case. Robert Lloyd Schellenberg sentenced to death for drug trafficking, drug smuggling, as I pointed out. But the death penalty in China is actually very, very rare. It's also outlawed in Canada. This seems like a sentence that was designed to make big headlines and maybe to be particularly offensive to the Canadian public.
Well, remember, he was arrested in 2014, convicted in 2016, and his appeals process was idle until all of a sudden, after the arrest of the CFO, it was resurrected.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm. And it was a trial that this was a trial that was carried out in a span of 12 hours that this sentence was handed down. Not only that, there were foreign observers who were allowed to come in and watch the process. So all indications are that this was not about the suspected drug trafficking as serious as a crime it is in China, but rather really signaling to Canada its concerns about the possible extradition of the CFO. And so just the circumstances around it are certainly unusual, not only for this case, but in cases in China in general. As you point out, the death sentence is taken quite seriously, as it should be in China. And it's rare that you hear that the beginning of to end of an appeals process all in the span of one day.
John Sobel.
There's a really important economic component to all of this. Huawei, which it doesn't really exist in the United States of America, is big in Canada. It's very big in the United Kingdom. You know, you go down a street in London and you'll find the road being dug up with cables being laid and it says Huawei. Now, in the US, you perhaps very wisely, arguable, have said, we're not having Chinese telecoms companies setting up because we don't know quite what their relationship is with the Chinese state, and we don't know whether this will kind of just be a means of them listening into everything that the Americans are doing. That hasn't been the case in other places. Mm-hmm. But in Britain, with 5G, and in Canada, they're starting to look at how big a role Huawei should have in their kind of telecoms infrastructure of their country. And I think the Chinese are looking at their economic expansion and being quite fearful if everyone starts saying, no, we're not going to go near you. And so I think China is flexing its muscles.
Jennifer.
That's a great point. And I just wanted to add to that I had, you know, honestly never, as an American, never really heard of Huawei until all of this started. And then the arrest of the CFO. But then I went home for the holidays for Christmas and my aunt passed me her cell phone and it was a Huawei cell phone. And I just kind of sat there staring at it going, okay, we're going to put this in the closet for a while I'm here. But it does seem that they are trying to at least penetrate the U.S. market slowly but surely.
Meanwhile, Meng Wanzhou, the CFO of Huawei that we're discussing, seems to be hoping that President Trump will step in on behalf of a case that his daughter has as well. And I wonder if he has any realistic hope of that.
Who knows what President Trump
These are chess pieces, in other words.
I mean, these are chess pieces. Yeah. And, you know, Donald Trump has got a chessboard with, you know, China, North Korea. Talks are going on today about when the next summit will be, whether it will happen. And he's got to know that all these things are interlinked, whether it be trade wars, whether it be Huawei, whether it be what happens in North Korea. China is a gateway to an awful lot. And therefore, if Donald Trump wants to win on his trade and wants to win on North Korea, he's going to have to give China something in return.
Well, before we go, and we are just about at that time, let's bring it back close to the border. We've been talking about our friends to the north, the Canadians. Our government shutdown, of course, in this country dragged on this week. We all know that. And while paychecks for a lot of government workers remain at zero, there's one shutdown-related story that did give us a smile at 1A this week. Air traffic controllers in Canada began sending pizzas to their furloughed colleagues here in the United States. So far, more than 300 boxes of pizza have been delivered to American air traffic controllers at work who are continuing to show up despite not being paid. They're keeping the airways safe, and while the government is unable to come to an agreement to pay them, Canada is at least keeping them full. And as somebody who went to college in Canada and was educated there, I can tell you that I've had more than my share of Canadian pizza. I want to give a shout out to Superplant on Rue Saint-Denis in Montreal, which nourished me one slice at a time for $1.73 through a couple of years at McGill University. Canada, you do know how to make pizza, and we thank you. We take back all of those bad jokes we ever made about you. You truly are nice. I want to thank all of my guests who are now thinking about what they're going to have for lunch. John Sopel is North American editor for the BBC, author of If Only They Didn't Speak English, Notes from Trump's America. Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Jennifer Williams, foreign editor at Vox, co-host of Worldly, Vox's foreign affairs podcast. I thank you all for being here. John, I hope that by the next time you come here on 1A, which I'm sure that you will, your migraine will
There'll
have subsided
no
significantly.
I'll bring aspirin.
Someone will bring something for John. Maybe it will be a Brexit deal. Who knows? 1A senior team is Denise Couture, Gabe Bullard, Danielle Knight, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our executive producer is Rupert Allman. The show was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about the staff, visit the website, the1a.org/staff. The show comes to you from WAMU, distributed by American University and NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.
Hey, thanks for listening. But before you go, we were wondering if you wouldn't mind helping us out with one more thing. Please tell a friend about this program. Text them. Tell them in person. Maybe just subscribe them to the show on their phone next time you're hanging out. If they trust you with their phone, they'll appreciate it. Thanks.